Yeah, one of the problems I have with this movie, and I know one of the problems, I believe it was Roger Ebert mentioned in the movie, it's like, what is the machine's motivation? Why did they do this to man? I mean, I guess we're learning that in the backstory in the second Renaissance anima mm-hmm. and Matrix movies. I mean, why? What's the motive? You know, you don't find out that
Oscar
motive
clip.
Here.
Oscar clip.
Oscar
clip.
Oscar clip is actually coming up, I think. But or MTV Movie Award clip, which I think he won for this. But you know, you don't really find. You know, one of the things that really is unfortunate in the movie, I think, is that you don't find out that motivation right away, or much at all, actually. I mean, I get the fact that, you know, they're using us as an engine or as a battery for the Matrix, basically. You know, they're using our life force as, or whatever, as a battery to run their illusion. But, you know, why did they do this to us in the first place? You know, one of the things.
What's explained in AI is that, you know, we made them too much, too fast, too many,
and you know, too smart.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank
and,
you.
And you know, it's funny that, you know, seeing the second Renaissance, it's sort of, this is sort of reminiscent of the Terminator,
yeah.
Which I don't think anybody really thought of at the time that this came out, but when you see, like, the second Renaissance and sort of the introduction of how the machines came to power, it's sort of very reminiscent of what happened in the Terminator movies.
Yeah, and that's what I was about to mention, is that, you know, I mean, I don't know, I mean, I know they do talk about kind of why it happened, you know,
yeah.
like towards the end, Agent Smith goes into the, you know, discussion with Lawrence Fishburne and discussing, you know, how they came to power and a bit of why. But you know, I mean, you've already
well.
Again, I mean, you got these guys who, you know, they know that we've all seen the Terminator and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I mean, I don't know if they needed to mention why.
Well, see, what basically Agent Smith says to Morpheus at the end is like, well, humans are a disease, they're a cancer, and we're the cure. Why are we considered a cancer? Why are we considered a disease, and why are they the cure? You don't really get that.
I thought he mentioned that. You know,
he does mention that at the end.
Sucking
but it's
up
like,
all the natural resources. You know, I mean, we are the parasite.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't really. I don't know. Maybe I, for some reason, forgot this since I last watched it on Sunday. But it's like, you know, I don't remember them giving a real motivation as to why they're doing this to us. Why they're, you know, why don't you just have us live in the real world and, you know, see, here's what we created, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel you, but then, you know, you go back to, you know, I mean, you know.
I mean, one of the more.
They want to take over. I mean, they don't want us on there, period. You know, I mean, they want us out. They
well,
want us exterminated.
Well, I mean, I'm down with that. But,
so, I mean, there you go.
But why? But why? I mean, there's. You know,
I mean, that's it.
Why?
That's it.
There's no motive there.
You know, I mean, that's as much motive as you get,
you know,
in Terminator.
But see, here's the thing here's the difference between those movies and this one.
Mm-hmm.
Those movies never really pretended to be anything more than, I think, and granted, I haven't seen them in a very long time. Never really pretend to be anything more than an action movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Those never really pretend to be anything more than an action movie.
No message.
Part of the problem I have with this movie is it pretends to be a philosophical discussion
right.
on, you know, the dangers of, you know, trusting our lives to technology and all that stuff.
Right.
I can get that watching 2001 and AI
mm-hmm.
far more profoundly. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I like about seeing the previews to Reload and Revolutions, it seems like they're getting the fact that, hey, you know, we've basically just created cool action movies. You know, basically create a cool action movie.
And
we're just running
that.
For that, you know.
And I feel that. And,
let's
and, you
drop
know,
the pretentious stuff and go right for the action.
And, you know,
you know?
For me, I just have to come back from the, the anime angle, you know, where you have the same thing, you have all these you have these great actors, but then you have this whole philosophical thing too. And, but you know, when it's anime, you normally have your series of 26 different, you know, TV shows, or you know, you've got your whole movie where you can explain it, and you've got like the movie that was made from the TV shows, and so you know that's almost always what you've got. And so so for them to be able to, and it's just a question of balance, you know, how could they balance that to be able to do the philosophical thing and the action to bring the anime to screen? And that was just, you know, I mean, I guess they just didn't get the balance right in some places, but I think they got the balance right enough to work, is my own point. This scene, I really like. This, you know, but what it reminds me of is, you know, kind of the first action sequence of the hero. And, you know, and so you got things like Superman where, you know, the first action sequence of the hero is pretty sweet. You know, Cross the Tiger, Hidden Dragon, pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. Then you have the decent ones, Born Identity. Then you have the kind of the crappy ones, which was Daredevil, in my opinion, but that's, we won't go there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Spider-Man was okay, too. But, you know, obviously, like they say,
well, this is, these guys, well, are, this is that video one game, where you know, the protagonist is basically finding out what he's capable of.
Right.
And,
right.
I mean...
Yeah, and I think from that standpoint, this really works well. And it was a really fun scene. You know, I mean, everybody's seen the video games that are kind of like this, the third person point of view martial arts, and now we're kind of watching it on screen, done pretty well. And so, like that.
Yeah, the choreography by, oh, I don't want to say his name because I know we'll get like hundreds of thousands of emails if I mispronounce it.
Are we that popular?
Well, not yet, but hopefully by this time, by the time this
is released, really cool. Morpheus is fighting Neo, and everybody starts jumping over the tables to come in. I thought that was pretty sweet.
Yeah. Wing Ying Wu-Ping, I want to say, is his name. God. I'm sorry, all of the martial arts fans and all of the fans of this movie. I'm not good with that name. I know he's done like Iron Monkey. He did Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. He's doing the upcoming Tarantino film, Kill Bill. I don't know. One of the things that bothered me, after I saw Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I caught a little bit of this on TV. It was either HBO or Fox or whoever was showing it. I think it was HBO. And after I saw Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I mean, these sequences just really didn't impress me anymore.
Oh, yeah,
they impressed
me
the first time.
Yeah, most
it wasn't so much because of all the parody we've seen since. It's just that, I don't know, I
definitely think, like, overall, and probably one-on-one, all the fight scenes in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon are better than all the fight scenes in The Matrix.
Yeah.
You know.
And one of the problems I have with that I've noticed is the use of slow motion. Now, I'm a big John Woo fan. I love John Woo's films, even his American films, so help me. But he has been the one director, I think, over the years who's really mastered the art of using slow motion in action sequences. He knows not to rely on it. He relies on action choreography, relies on setting up the location, setting up the situation and all that stuff. Performance and all that. So see his movies, if you don't believe me, his Hong Kong films, Face Off, whatever. My feeling about the use of sci-fi or slow-mo in here is it's too much of a good thing. It's too much of a good thing, and you start to see a little bit of that in this sequence.
One moment that I just liked right there was the Lawrence Fishburne teaching moment. I thought he played that off pretty well.
I like that because why one of the main reasons I get such a kick out of the sequence is because when he asks him, "Do you think that's air that you're breathing?" and he realizes that, you know, he's in a computer program, he doesn't have to be out of breath.
Right.
And that's when I start. That's when I start to really find this moment to be downright breathless because you're not seeing what I like is you're not seeing the characters out of breath. And I think that's a really neat little detail, because then you start to, then you really do start to feel as if, you know, I mean, well, that's when I, that's, this is just another moment when I'm just really left breathless, I think.
Right. And, you know, I mean, about the slow motion thing, Brad, I definitely feel you on that one. But when I think about that, I'm still coming from the anime standpoint. And when
when you
look at those sequences, you know, I mean, they take slow motion sequences, you know, almost at the next level that this movie does.
I don't know. I think part of the reason I can kind of accept a more anima than I do here is because of the fact that slow motion is a very rare thing to see in animation. And apparently it's very hard to pull off in animation.
Right.
Whereas here, all you have to do is you basically slow down the camera, and that's basically about it. I mean, there's very little to it in...
Yeah, but what I really liked about the commentary right there was, I think John Gator was talking about, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, how Lawrence Fishburne made it look like he actually did the jump right there. You know, just look, the way he looked at stuff like that, and that, I think that's just another excellent performance.
You mean he actually gave credit to somebody else but himself?
Yeah, amazingly enough. I think that's because his special effects shot was right there was kind of crappy.
Yeah, I just saw Bulletproof Monk, and this frame sequence reminds me a lot of what you saw in Bulletproof Monk today. There's a lot of similarities.
But Brian, wasn't this one of the very first DVDs to like really go through the ceiling?
It was. I mean, unfortunately, I've never seen the movie or the DVD because I've never been much of a fan of the movie. But yes, apparently, it was the first one to sell a million copies. It was basically for a while the standard by which everybody set DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the creativity in it. You know.
Well, I mean, one of my memories of this movie is when I was living with some guys who were, you know, who weren't movie buffs like I was or whatever, and walking through the room after they had, I think this is before I had a DVD player. This is actually one of the first DVDs I was actually introduced to in a way. But I remember just walking through the room and one of my roommates watching this with a commentary, you know, and he didn't strike me as somebody who would be interested in that sort of thing. But I think this DVD release was one of the first to introduce people to that sort of
seeing the benefits of an audio commentary.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you have the filmmakers actually going through it step by step. I mean, there were ones actually before this. Again, I've got to give credit to Dark City because they've got a couple of excellent commentaries on
one
that
including
one,
Roger
one
Ebert.
With, by Roger Ebert, one by the filmmakers. It really takes you through that film quite well.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the coolest training sequences I see. Lawrence Fishburne's walking through, not getting hit. Keanu Reeves is getting hit left and right. Yeah, that's again just that's just some good ideas right there. Again, stolen. They're not good ideas. And I guess Lawrence Fishburne right there is getting the exposition too. But because of the sequence, I think that kind of works. Right there.
It does kind of work. The fact that you have all these people going one way,
mm-hmm.
one of them not getting hit at all,
right.
and then the other, you know, sort of sensing the idea that it's like, hey, he knows how to go through the, you know, he knows his way around here.
Yeah, and, you know, even though it was not kind of a
it's
fast action sequence.
Even though there's doves there, by the way.
Yeah, another sort of homage to John Woo. Doves. Now, here's one thing I've been racking my brain about the past couple of times I've seen it. Are the agents the Sentinels, or what's the deal there? I mean, are they supposed to be like the, you know, are they sort of the equivalent of what the Sentinels are in
the
real world,
are, yeah.
or are they separate entities? Or?
Referring back to the Terminator, I think the Sentinels are like, you know, the T-100s, you know, and
okay.
maybe the agents are kind of like the T-1000s. You know, you ever thought about it that way? You know, like
no,
the,
but like I
T-1000.
Said, it's been a while since I've
well,
seen
yeah,
the two
I mean, it's
Terminator
just,
movies.
It sounds like, you know, I mean, these are the agents are the Sentinels for inside the Matrix.
Okay.
You know,
mm-hmm.
kind of sort of.
But, I mean, you know, do they translate that way to where it's like, you know, I get the fact that they're sort of like, they sort of have the same purpose that the Sentinels have
right.
in the real world, right. but I mean, you know, are the two connected in
a sense? I think they're two different entities.
Myself. Okay. I just think they're two completely different things just to make the world more interesting. Hopefully it'll be explained more in the sequels, but
yeah. Now, I have to admit, you know, is going back to what I said about not really being impressed or about what they did as far as the visual look of the Matrix, I have to say I've gotten progressively more impressed with the whole idea about what the real world looks like. Really, you know, really has impressed me a lot more, having seen this a couple of times. You know, the Sentinels do look pretty cool, although,
right.
actually, it's funny, watching, you know, Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, now that we've opened the can of worms over, you know, it's like taking ideas from one movie, putting them in another. Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within sort of kind of took the look of its decimated world and some of the spirits from this.
Right. At least that's what it looks like.
Yeah. Although I thought that movie worked a little better than this one does, which I know I'm in the minority in that case.
Yeah, I'm sure. I know I'm in the minority in that case. I know you are.
You can get lynched for half the things you've already said during this.
Oh, I know. But you know what? We more or less live in a free country where we're free to say whatever we want.
Why don't you just put on the hat thing?
It's a good question. Aren't they doing the electromagnetic pulse? And they've got the jacks in the back.
Well, nobody else. The thing is, not everyone else has one.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he's super sensitive or something like that. Because he was.
I think the reflection off his bald head or something. I mean, look at that. Yes, this is definitely such a scene right here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has hair around there, so.
Right.
Everyone just decided to go with a really cool ball book.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing to me that ever made Morpheus cool was, like, the small little sunglasses
and the trench coat.
Mm-hmm. But then again, you put anybody in that look, they're going to probably look cool.
If you put me in that look, I'd look cool. Yeah. So
well,
that's saying a lot.
You could put me in that look, and I'd look kind of, sort of cool.
Joe Pantoliano,
the killer pimp from Risky Business, also another veteran of Memento. It's funny that two people in this movie were also in Memento, another one of those really highly acclaimed movies by movie geeks like ourselves.
Also from the Fugitive movies.
Oh, that's right. I forgot he was in The Fugitive.
Yeah.
And I think he has a lot to the movie, even though his character doesn't have that big of a part.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just
he's one of those actors who's just inherently cool.
Right.
Well,
I have a little bit.
I have a little bit of a bone to pick with him because I don't find him he's supposedly now one of these. Actors who, you know, you put him in a movie and he makes it cool. You know, he was on The Sopranos for a while until he got killed off.
That's
but,
right.
I just don't find him, you know, to be that, you know, I'm not trying to, like, you know, talk like a 16-year-old throughout this whole entire, you know, discussion of this actor, but I just don't find him to be that, you know, that quote-unquote, you know, cool or whatever.
I think depending on the movie, he has like levels of coolness.
Yeah,
I think he's always, in my opinion, he's always, you know, kind of base level cool.
I mean,
he's kind
of. Let's put it this way: I think the epitome of cool for him was as Guido, the killer pimp,
mm-hmm.
in Risky Business. I mean, but still, he's
mm-hmm.
pretty cool in everything. He's pretty good in everything else, in my
mm-hmm.
opinion. I'm trying to think of what else he's been in.
Daredevil.
Oh, that's right. He was in Daredevil too. I know he's been
He comes across as somebody who, like, kind of like, he, as an actor anyway, he comes across as somebody who thinks he's cool, And I just can't appreciate somebody who thinks they're that all that.
Well, have you seen Memento?
I have. I have. Okay. I mean, he's great. He's just as good in that as he is in all of his other performances. I just he's like somebody who just
I feel that.
Who comes across as somebody who thinks he's all that, and I don't want to go off on a rant on as minor a character as this, or well, I mean, as you know, as small a part. Anyway.
I mean, I feel that it's just. I think you know, you have some actors out there who think they're cool, and then you know they're crap.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
he thinks he's cool, and you know, he makes it work most.
To
of
a
time.
Degree, he is.
And he is certainly cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good harp song.
Trying to think of what
this conversation right here reminds me of. There's some stuff in the Animatrix program when when they're flying on the horses and they're talking about
he wants to go back into the Matrix. Yeah.
How people could feel more comfortable in a virtual world than in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's one of the points that the directors are trying to bring up.
Yeah,
I don't know if they kind of. I mean, I think Program got that point across more than you know in its short 10-15 minutes that it is than this movie did.
This is actually. I'll admit it kind of did. I wasn't that impressed with Program when I first saw it, but
I've never. Noticed.
I mean, I love the animation in all of the Animatrix.
I'm superb.
I can't say enough about it. It's absolutely brilliant. I would buy the DVD just for the animation alone. I wasn't that impressed with Program first time I saw it, but yeah, I've seen it a couple more times, and yeah, I really do like it a lot more.
Yeah.
Although I still think Second Renaissance is the most complete of the bunch.
I never noticed how he was just sitting there enjoying all the fruits of you know the Matrix and everything, you know the Cuban cigar and the and the steak and the wine and everything, and then you cut right to. These guys eating the slop, which is actually kind of like a funny little in joke I just noticed.
Who is this guy?
I don't know.
The little one is Mouse.
What's the name of him?
Yeah.
What's the name of the character?
The little one is Mouse.
Character.
For some reason, I always laugh at that.
Oh, Mouse, Matt Dorn.
The little one.
What else he's been
the little one behind you is Mouse. For some reason, I always laugh at that line because it's such a cornball line. But
I think it's a shame that they killed him off because. He
killed a lot of these characters.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I have to kind of get the character count down because I mean, all these guys have kind of really minor parts. But I think out of the guys that had the minor parts,
notice Dave how it's all the ethnic parts as well. It's all the.
Sounds like he made a movie.
Yeah.
I think he had one of the cooler minor parts.
Yeah.
At least as far as the script goes, is his dialogue.
I don't know. One of the problems I had with this movie, same problem I had with actually.
You had a problem with this movie?
Gee, have you not figured that out? Anyway, had a problem with. Also thought that the Wachowskis' first movie, Bound, was pretty overrated. Anybody who hasn't seen it, it's basically like your typical
also
40s
with Joe
film. Also with Joe Pantoliano and Gene Gershon. And
I can't Jennifer pronounce his name
Chili.
To save my life.
Anyway, one of the problems I had with that movie was anybody who hasn't seen it, it's essentially a 40s film noir shot in color with style to spare, but the only difference between it and a Bogey and Bacall movie is it's basically Bacall and Bacall. You have two, you know, your main protagonists are both female, and that's about the only difference between that and any other movie.
And they're both lesbians.
Anyway. Thank you very much. I was trying to go for some tact in that area.
But they're,
but
they're both
let's put
lesbians.
It this way. Tact is something, chances are an audience for this commentary is, you know, who cares? I mean, they much.
But that's what I am for this one, for this commentary. I'm the comic relief.
One thing I haven't talked about is their the clothes that they're wearing.
The clothes.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they, of course, they're trying to go for the typical, you know, futuristic cool effect, the sunglasses, you know, the black trench coat.
Although it actually is just much slicker than any futuristic movie ever.
Yeah.
I mean, most futuristic movies, you know, Mad Max and Blade Runner and stuff like that.
It's just an excuse to make them
looking clothes. Here, it's slick.
Yeah.
They got this stuff from Armani.
Well, it's an excuse to make the characters look cool. That's all it is.
Right,
yeah. I mean, that's...
But, you know, I also like the costumes when they're in the Matrix, though. You know, they have that kind of, like, you know, moth-eaten quality to them. And,
the idea that, I mean, they basically had to dig this stuff out of rubble and stuff like that.
And also the fact that the Matrix has a very cold, cold, kind of bitter quality to it as well.
That's part of the problem I had with this movie in general was that, I mean, you know, I've watched this and it's like, it is... The movie's part of the reason I don't like it as much as Dark City or some of the other movies that have dealt with this concept is it strikes me, this movie in particular strikes me as sort of pretty cold and kind of cynical. There's not really a whole lot of feeling to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's slick. Slick as can be.
You know,
I mean,
again,
style coming out of every corner of this movie.
And again, that's interesting to hear you say that because I know how big of a fan you are of that sort of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
I like the idea that it's cold and kind of bitter and kind of, you know, unsafe. I've always kind of been able to appreciate that.
Well, there's a difference between instilling a sense of sort of dread or paranoia or whatever you want to call it. There's a difference between that and just being completely cut off from any feeling whatsoever. Or, you know, it's not so much a difference, but there's a difference in styles of movie making.
Right.
And, I mean, this seems to me very detached emotionally. I mean, they tried to tried to harness in a love story between Neo and Trinity that doesn't work.
I think it's going to be explored more in the sequels.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes with a movie, I forget that, you know, this is just kind of a setup for, you know, I mean, two more movies that were already in the pipeline and are already going to happen.
Because they did plan on this as a trilogy all from the beginning.
Right. And Brian, I feel you about the emotional thing. I just, when I think about that, I try to find the emotion in the performances, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it comes through.
It definitely comes through with Keanu. You know, I mean, you know, his his performance.
Lawrence Fishburne and Carrie Ann Moss.
Emotes more emotion, I think.
Well,
that's the emotion.
That's part of the problem I have with this is I don't feel it.
You
guys don't feel like. Here we go again, mentioning it for the fifth straight commentary. The chemistry between Kirsten Dunst and Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man.
Did not feel it. Did
you
not
guys didn't feel,
feel
I don't
it.
Feel
don't
any,
get me started.
I don't feel any real emotion in here. I mean, I'm not asking for bawling your eyes out sentimentality, because God knows I can't stand that.
Right.
Anybody who knows my opinion on Armageddon can tell you that.
I think
but,
Some of the emotion.
Is this recording?
Yes.
Okay.
Some of the emotion was being brought out by kind of the disturbing sequences, you know, in the beginning, the baby being hooked up to the.
That's
kind of scene right here. Actually, I mean, that kind of works as sort of bringing across the emotion. And then. Who is this lady? Gosh, I forget her name.
Gloria.
I'm about
to find that out.
This actress has passed away since.
Gloria Foster, the late Gloria Foster, who is going to be in Reloaded, but she's not. They actually rewrote the story for what was left, I believe, of Reload and then all of Revolutions to make sense of her passing within the story. Right. But she is going to be in Reload. Anybody who's seen the final trailer for that knows that she's going to be in it a bit. This is kind of an alright scene, except for the fact that you have a couple hundred more mentions of Neo being the one, and one thing I have yet to mention, the not-so-subtle use of religious symbolism, the idea of the one person, you know, the savior,
But, I mean, you see that throughout some of the movies. It's not even
funny. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, anything that's based on certain degree of mythology or has a certain amount of mythology created for it.
And that is also consistent with anime.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
But it's, you know, like I said, it's beaten like a dead horse in this movie. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think the Oracle bring, you know, having seen this recently, I mean, Gloria Foster as the Oracle does bring a certain degree of levity to it.
Right.
You know, she does bring a lot of levity to this performance. I mean, it's probably the, I don't know. It's one of the better performances in the movie.
Most definitely. Almost one of the best.
One thing we haven't mentioned, and one thing I definitely don't want to go about this entire commentary without mentioning, is Don Davis, the composer, who in an essay I wrote for my intro electric acoustic music class, actually, I did an essay on electroacoustic music and science fiction films. I said, the musical score for The Matrix was disappointing. Admittedly, Don Davis's music is a superb and highly inventive piece of orchestral action film scoring and one of the year's best scores, but when I first saw the previews, I was hoping for a score more like the purely electronica one I heard in Pi, composed by Quentin Mansell, as opposed to one that seemed more fit for the next Lethal Weapon or Die Hard movie. I do still feel that way, although I do have the score in my collection, and I do agree that it is a very good score. Listening to it more recently, it does strike me as being very experimental as far as the orchestral aspect is concerned. Reminds me a lot of what Jerry Goldsmith and Danny Elfman brought to their respective Planet of the Apes ventures. But I am disappointed. I'm still disappointed that they didn't go for more fusion of synthesizers and what have you in the score, because that's what I was really looking forward to when I first saw the previews to this movie. Mm-hmm. I know, Ron, you wanted to mention something on that.
I know you wanted to bring it up. Not a problem, because, you know, I'm a film music score connoisseur of sorts myself, and I really did notice, especially recently, the last few times I've watched this, is I really did notice how much I was able to appreciate the balance between orchestral and techno music.
A great deal. I mean, the entire score is predominantly orchestral. I don't think there are very few uses of synthesizers in this. It's not, you know, one of the best of fusing the two is Jerry Goldsmith, who did a fantastic score for Total Recall, which is another movie based on Philip K. Dick that also fuses virtual reality and, you know, reality well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this, you know, I like that, you know, some of the things you hear in this, there are some great musical passages this that do remind me of those Planet of the Apes scores. And then there's some stuff that's more like Michael Kamen and Die Hard and Lethal Weapon and stuff like that. But I still really like the score.
Oh, I do too.
I really enjoy it. I'm looking forward to it. And I love what it's done for the... Don Davis is continuing to score. He scored the Animatrix movies, and he's scoring the next two ones. I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does in the upcoming movies. And I love what... And I hope they actually do sort of like a score for the Animatrix, score album for the Animatrix, because I love what he's written there.
I was wondering,
this cue in particular is coming up.
If the cookie is like some type of symbol, because I know Morpheus kind of smiled when she saw him walk out with the cookie.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the cookie was like some kind of symbol saying, yes, he's won, and then keep rolling. You know, I always wondered that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love this cue. This is probably my favorite cue of the entire
thing. Oh, yeah. This
is one of the things that I love, the introduction percussion.
Right.
I love the, you know, sort of arpeggiated thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, going on in the winds and what you have in strength. It's just, it's one of the better action sequence cues I've heard in recent years.
Most definitely.
I mean, You know, it's one of those ones that I really have enjoyed listening to. Yeah. Sorry. Just listening to this. Oh, I love it.
Man, and so...
This is one of the more conventional parts of the score, but it's done so well. I mean, it fits so perfectly with the rest of the score. It works.
This the sort of deja vu explanation right here is it's kind of just one of the things I like about the movie, how they kind of take regular things and kind of, you know, explain it in terms of the Matrix, you know, things you wouldn't need to think about. I don't know, that's sort of a anime reminiscent type thing.
Yeah, I do admit, watching this, I do like that idea of deja vu being a sort of a thing leading these guys to believe, you know, the agents are onto us or something like that. You know, sort of a glitch in the system.
Right.
You know, I do like that idea of how they use deja vu. Now here's one of the problems, and I want to mention it later as well.
I love this little guy bringing out the big guns. Yeah.
Now, is the police force in... Now, are these cops, like, real cops, or are they aligned with the agents, or what's the deal here? Are they real people who are programmed in the Matrix to be... cops.
One of the problems
I have with this movie, and I know one of the problems my mother has with this movie is, you know, the idea that it's like, okay, guns don't really work on the agents, and yet they want, like, thousands of them, you know, when they go to, say, Morpheus later, and when they have them when they're trying to use them here, when they're trying to get out here, and it's like, okay, if they know that guns won't work necessarily against the agents, what's the point in having them?
Well, I think it's because, I mean, when you even watch it, I mean, most of the time they're not fighting agents. You know, I think almost there's a set number of agents. I mean, I'm not even quite sure that, you know, if they move fast enough, the agents won't find them. And, you know, and you can see that kind of at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And so you know, and then as far as the police force is concerned, I don't know, I always got the idea that from the police standpoint, these guys are kind of like terrorists, criminals, like something like that, and they're just kind of being hunted down, shoot to kill, mm-hmm. highly dangerous, whatever, what have you, you know.
Well, see, one of the problems I have with this, and I'm just really thinking of this now that I'm thinking about this, you know, is that, I mean, you know, if the police officers are sort of like the agents, except not on that level, sort of like an earlier generation of agents, you know, I can buy that. You know, I could buy that if they explain that. But, I mean, if these are sort of like real people programmed into the Matrix to be police officers...
Yeah, it's kind of a morbid thought.
The idea that they're going to shoot and kill the very people they're trying to save, it doesn't really... The logic of that doesn't really fit.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know...
Are they all right with this? Do they understand what they're doing?
I guess that's the whole point, is that, you know, they don't understand. You know, I mean, they're just being told that these guys are terrorists, whatever, and, I mean, they don't know that these guys are terrorists.
No, I'm not talking about the police officers. I'm talking about, I mean, do Morpheus and Trinity and all these guys, I mean, do they understand that, you know, do they know... But aren't telling us that these guys are real people, are programmed into the Matrix to be police officers, and do they realize the moral implication of having to kill?
I do see exactly.
some of the very people that they're trying to liberate by destroying the Matrix.
That is an interesting.
I think they may have tried to. I don't know, save that or what have you by the first training sequence, saying that, you know, anybody who is not one of us is an enemy. So, you know, okay, you're gonna have to shoot these guys. These guys are gonna try to shoot you, you know.
I mean they set up well the idea that the agents can basically switch, not so much switch bodies, but basically
take over
yeah. a body
right.
of somebody that they have programmed in the Matrix.
Right.
But I mean,
I feel that. I mean, I just I think they tried to set it up, but you know the idea is still kind of brutal. I guess maybe you know you can kill a few people, save everybody, you know. You know, I mean, and they are trying to avoid contact as much as possible. I mean, that's part of their thing.
Yeah.
And I guess they shoot only when they have to.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, like at the end, you know, that the part when you see Neo and Trinity walk into that building, that lobby with all the gear and everything. That's supposed to be like another moment in the movie where you're supposed to feel really charged and really, really excited by, you know, what's about to happen. And, you know, you're supposed to, and the audience is basically trained in a way to cheer after they blow all these policemen away.
Right. Yeah. You know? I mean, you know, it's a very gratuitous action sequence for...
Yeah, it is. It's very...
You know, the type of philosophical argument this movie is trying to actually... You know,
and I think that's just another balance thing, you know.
I mean,
as far as like the anime thing is concerned, that'd be a pretty sweet action sequence, you know. But the thing trying to come from the philosophical thing, it just doesn't quite work. And so, you know, I mean,
I guess the best way for me to enjoy this movie is just not think about it,
right?
And sort of take it for what I think it is, which is a glorified action movie.